Welcome to another episode of This Anthro Life. As always, I'm Ryan Collins.
And I'm Adam Gamwell.
And This Anthro Life is brought to you in collaboration from the American Anthropological Association, the Society for Applied Anthropology, and of course, Sapiens. Now, today, we have a pretty cool episode. We're doing something a little bit different for the first time, and we're talking with Andrew Rowan, who's an author of the new novel, Encounters Unforeseen, 1492, retold. Now, this novel takes a bicultural perspective on this contact period and the initial contacts between Columbus and the Taino natives of Haiti today. Mm-hmm. So this is getting into something really cool that's not just bicultural, telling stories from both sides, but talking about the encounter and what it means to be crossing cultural boundaries in a way that was really not foreseen in this time period.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a really interesting conversation, and we get to dig into a ton of issues, you know, that both stylistically about what creative choices one can take, because when you're writing creative fiction, of course, you can have choice of where and when you start the story. And so one of the interesting things that he does that we'll talk about is rather than starting at 1492, he actually starts in the 1450s when Christopher Columbus and Isabel and Ferdinand, the king and queen of Spain at the time, and a lot of the Taino chieftains who may become the main protagonists in the story are all children. And the idea of this is to sort of knock off the pedestal of history, or like the idea of these like monolithic and mythical figures, and say, what happens? These are just people too.
Right.
And help set the context for how something comes to take place.
Exactly. And from an anthropological perspective, we can appreciate this because it sets up a dynamic of becoming, right? Mm-hmm. Because culture is learned through education, through enculturation, through growth and development. So this allows you to see these characters in learn their own culture as you learn it along with them, and it makes everyone human and equal across the board, as well as it also sets up a paradigm of becoming that can be linked into gender studies that we often see in archaeology as well. Mm-hmm. With childhood being treated not only as a separate phase of life but also sometimes as a separate gender.
Yeah, right on. And so there's a lot of good thoughts that come out in this conversation, and so we'll offer some reflections too, like we're doing now. And so we just hope you enjoy it. You know, sit back and relax and enjoy Andrew Rowan and his new novel, Encounters Unforeseen, 1492, retold. One of the interesting pieces of this book, besides, I mean, thank you so much for sharing it with us. It's been a really enjoyable read, is this. You know, we're at this interesting date, right? We're at the 525th anniversary of the voyages of Christopher Columbus, or Cristobal Colón, we might say. And so, you know, kind of one of our first thoughts and questions with this would be, you know, what inspired you to take on this novel? This is a huge undertaking in terms of research, and also just with a, you know, contested as well as world-known, you know, figure and event that has changed what we call the course of history. You know, what inspired you to kind of get into this this storytelling?
Well, I've always read a lot of history, mostly academic history, and, you know, researched historical novels. And there's a lot of accounts in the 18th and 19th century about the settlement of the Americas and the Christianization of North America, South America, that are bicultural. You can see in the accounts both a European and a Native American viewpoint. Hmm. For example, there are lots of books written about Sitting Bull side by side with General Custer, where you could see both men's thoughts and strategies and actions. When you go further back in history, 17th, 16th century, those kind of works diminish in number. There are some. There are some very good ones. When you get back to 1492, there really isn't anything that I would call a bicultural history. You have some children's books that are bicultural. You have some novels from the Native American perspective. But you don't have an attempt to have Columbus, Isabella, Ferdinand side by side with the Taino chieftains of the Caribbean. And at some point it began to bother me. I began reading the primary sources, and it became a hobby. I began going to sites to investigate the Taino peoples. And eventually I determined that the subject matter was really knowable. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not a professional academic. I was a lawyer by training. But the primary sources, by that I mean primary historical sources, not anthropological works, relating to the event, were fairly discreet. You could put all of them on a, you know, dining room table stacked fairly high. So I saw that I could read them in 2 or 3 years, as opposed to writing something about a modern person like a Washington or a Lincoln, where the primary source evidence you'd have to sort through and study and understand would be, you know, voluminous, take up, you know, floors and floors of buildings. So, rightly or wrongly, I guess, I decided that I thought I could study 1492 from a bicultural perspective and write the account that I felt was missing. And it did take me 3 or 4 years of research to do it. You know, I've always been interested in the settlement of the Americas, and this was a natural extension of it. I've also been interested in the roots of religious intolerance and the Christianization of the New World was a topic that I'd always read about and interest me a lot. Was religion a motivating factor for what happened, or was it a justification, an excuse?
Now, of course, with these types of narratives, that's absolutely something that we have to consider, right? What is the role of religion? And speaking of primary sources, I actually have a copy of Bartolomé de las Casas in front of me, and one of his descriptions of the Taino, a short one, is, these people are among the cleanest and the most unoccupied of the inhabitants of the earth, and of a lively understanding, very apt, intractable for all fair doctrine, exceedingly fit to receive our holy Catholic faith, and to be imbued with the virtuous customs, and the people with the fewest impediments to this that God has created upon the earth. I have been told by many other Spaniards that the goodness they see in these Indians is not to be denied. In sooth, these people were the most fortunate in the world, if they but knew God. And I mean, this is a sentiment that seems to be very much shared with all of the early writings about the Taino, and this must have been a very difficult thing for you to sort through, Andrew, because there really aren't that many documents.
You're right, there aren't that many documents. You take Bartolomé de las Casas, who you just cited, and he was probably the most voluminous writer. He came over as a conquistador and then had a conversion and became the, quote, defender of the Indians. And he saw them through this kind of Christian light that you just read about, how they would be brought to the faith. There were other chroniclers. Columbus himself was a voluminous writer. They're mostly reports to his bosses, Isabella and Ferdinand, or instructions to people that worked for him. But there is a substantial body of his writings from 1492, commencing with the journal, through his death in 1506. There are others that, you know, you might portray as more brutal from a conquistador perspective. There are chroniclers like Fernandez de Oviedo. There's Andres Bernaldez. There's Peter Danguera, Peter Martyr Danguera, who was a humanist at Isabel's court. There also was a friar that Columbus took to the New World in 1494 on his second voyage, who he instructed to write an account of the Taino religion and spirits. And that fellow, Ramon Panay, wrote a small booklet or pamphlet, which basically constitutes the knowledge, or the original source of the knowledge we have today about the Taino religion as it was practiced in the 15th century. So there are quite a few different chroniclers. There are also people that went across with Columbus on a subsequent voyages that wrote letters back. Some were doctors. Some were just boyhood friends. Some were other friars. Some were military people. So you have a not overwhelming source, but you do have a good source of viewpoints, all European viewpoints, on what happened. The Tainos obviously didn't have written language, so I had to resort, after you get past the European chroniclers, to reading the works of modern anthropologists and trying to piece from their work and their analysis of Taino society and activities and experiences, together with the facts you learn about the Tainos from the European chroniclers, what their history was, really.
So with all of that, how was your process of finding the Taino voice? Was it challenging for you in ways? And when you found it, did you recognize it?
Well, I hope I recognized it. The process was to start with the written European historical record, as I just described, which does describe various events prior to 1492 on the Taino side. In other words, it does describe the chieftains who they met, their ascensions to power, some of their marriages, their religious beliefs, as seen through the eyes of this European friar, at any rate. It describes what happened to them in detail, some detail, after 1492, starting with the Columbus seized captives to help them go around the Caribbean. They were forced to be guides and interpreters, and he brought them back to Spain in 1493. And in 1493, you can start reading what happened to them. They were baptized at Isabella and Ferdinand's court. And then from 1493 on, the subjugation occurred, the war that occurred, Columbus, you know, and his men overran what he called Hispaniola, the modern Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. And the accounts tell you what happened to various chieftains that are in my book. So I went to the anthropological sources and figured out, you know, an anthropologist, as you guys know better than I, don't always agree on things. But what were practices and things that Tainos did, such as how did they hunt, or how did they Certainly. Travel? They were seafarers. They went around the Caribbean and, you know, dug out canoes. What were their leisure games? They played a game which they called Beti, which is kind of a cross between, I think, soccer and volleyball. And this has all been studied by, you know, archaeologists, anthropologists, and so forth. And so to do the pre-1492 stories in my book relating to the Tainos, I put the historic figures that you know about in those events as they grew up, or those practices. For example, the very first Taino story in the book is about the boy that becomes the historic Taino chieftain Keanabo, learning how to duck hunt. So, it, you know, there is no history showing that Keanabo hunted duck when he was 8 years old on Middle Caicos. The Taino word for that island was Aniana. The story is about a valid historic person doing a documented practice that there's little dispute how it actually occurred. And the geographic placement of Keanabo on that island I took from a modern anthropologist's work, William Keegan, who is a curator of the museums in Florida, who speculated that Guyana Bo was born there. And so pre-1492, the Tainos stories are constructed that way. You know things about who married who, and you know that they had skirmishes, wars, battles with another indigenous tribe down there, the Caribs in the Eastern Antilles. So there's a story about that. You know they experienced hurricanes. There's a story about that. You know, their anthropologists know their burial and afterlife worship practices. And so there's a story like that. When it gets to October 12, 1492, have Columbus's day-to-day journal. At that point in the story, actually slightly before that, I could recount the European viewpoint of what happened. You know, what did Columbus do this day? And then in a mirror image, try to reconstruct what the fellow on the other side, Guyana Bo or Guacanagari or another chieftain or one of the captives he took, what was he seeing from his point of view, educated, at least I believe educated, by the understanding of the Taino culture, that education that he had and that I depicted in the first half of the book.
That was actually a form of writing that I really enjoyed in the book, was thinking through this idea of right, what do we have in Columbus's journals, and then sort of how would you put the story together from the other side. And I thought what worked well for me in this case is just that the sort of mixing, even between paragraphs, right, of how Columbus, you know, who you use the Spanish name Cristobal Colón, which makes way more sense, obviously, and then sort of juxtapose these with Taino viewpoints. And it was interesting to see that, too, because you're right, like they're sort of kept at the same par, which I think is important. And for this kind of work of historical fiction that also really you can tell is ethnographically grounded in deep research. And so I thought that was nice.
Adam, that's a real, real important point that you just said that was very important to me, that I wanted a book that put both the Taino and European protagonists on equal footing, equal gravity, and focus as human beings with, you know, an equivalency of importance. It does go back and forth like that, and that's what I'm trying to achieve. And frankly, that's why I had to write it as a novel. Because pre-1492 and post-1492, you don't have, because the Tainos didn't record their own history in writing, you don't have the depth of information you have. So you have to fictionalize to make it comparable.
Right. The way that you wrote this novel, especially with these fictionalized accounts that are based in cultural action, really resonated with me and reminded me of Gary Jennings' Aztec to a certain degree, with reflecting on cultural practice.
I read that book. That's an excellent book. And together with William Volman's The Ice Shirt, which is the Norse Skraling Encounters in Canada, those were two guides on how I approached it. I thought those two writers really did get into the heads of people they were writing about, and that's what I wanted to achieve.
That reminds me, actually, you know, because we've talked before on this show, but also just out and about as well, that there is really some nice capacity of fiction and novelization and to sort of capture the human experience in the everyday life. And that's something that novels do spectacularly well, and they've done since they were invented. And, you know, and it's interesting, too, in this regard to think about, you know, because obviously when you're writing fiction, you get to choose where and when the story starts, even though, of course, we're talking with historical figures and recorded events. And so I think one of the interesting sort of time choices and stylistic choices and creative choices you made was when you began the events of the novel, right? You began in childhood for most of the main characters that we have heard about in history. And so I'm curious if you can kind of talk us and break us down a little bit of that, of why we began in the 1450s, right? When you know, 1492 is the famous date for those that don't know the story too well, but you you know, began as much earlier than that in the 1450s. Can you tell us a bit about why you chose to do that and how you put it together?
Yeah, it's very important to me when I read historical fiction or history that I'm reading something valid. Hmm. What I wanted to do was write something valid, that everything I put in the book was something I believed likely could have happened, even though I know that I don't know that it happened, just like I illustrated with the duck hunting story in Ganobo as a Boy. You don't know that happened, mm-hmm. but it's likely it could have happened. I wanted to start in youth because I wanted to take everyone off the pedestal they have in history. Mm-hmm. Columbus has a tremendous pedestal. Whether you believe he's terrible or good or in between, he's a controversial figure that, you know, anything and everything has been said about. And I mm-hmm. wanted to start with Columbus and with Canabou and Guacangari and all the others, Isabel and Fernand, in youth, when Columbus was nothing. Isabella, as a girl in medieval Spain, you know, she was nothing. No one thought she was going to be who she came out to be. Mm. And so I wanted to take everyone off their pedestal and start from scratch. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be able to explore and explain their societies, their religions, their maturation and outlook before I got to the encounter. So that when you get to the encounter, which starts about halfway through the book, you have a feel for why each of these protagonists is reacting the way they did. Mm-hmm. And so lots of books that do this, and I must say I took a lot of comments from people who told me, don't write so much in the beginning. Start sooner to the event. But then what you're doing is leaving out the explanation of why the person reacted the way they did, mm-hmm. which I thought I wanted be the main focus of the book, really. Why did it happen the way it did? Why did they react the way they did in 1492 and 1493? It's because they had educations and, you know, marriages and love affairs and so forth, and religious viewpoints and, you know, a political focus that they brought to that event.
Right. I really like the way that you just described the whole approach, because when we're dealing with narratives at this period of time that are talking about contact, and especially through the conquests that ensue afterwards, we have these mythical narratives of the larger-than-life figures, right? Columbus certainly being one of them. So making these individuals much more approachable and putting them in a perspective where they can be understood as a person rather than the myth is something that I found very compelling about your work.
That's what I was trying to do. Very good point.
Yeah, I think speaking with that too, there's this question, you know, in these kind of books, I mean, we're talking about historical authenticity, like mixed with this, with fiction and mixed with ethnographic accounts and you know, in-depth stories of what everyday life is like. And so it's I think what works well about this and what's interesting to think with, right, is that in this case, you know, we all know the larger historical arc that we live today. But, you know, what's, I think what's important about this piece in the story itself, right, the Taino protagonists, they were neither like written as victims nor as statistics, right? These were full people too. And this is kind of just to reiterate this point. I think it was key because, again, this is how life would be. And so I think it makes a lot of good sense to sort of give this, you know, lives of them ahead of time, as it were, or to really just life as it was lived as children, to sort of put in the place of why religion seemed like such a generative force, why spirituality was such a powerful condition through which both different groups saw both the encounter and their lives ahead of time with the different storm gods, as well as the idea of, you know, the Virgin Mary and Christ the Redeemer and these different kinds of both religious figures, but also spiritual, however you want to call them. And I think that, you know, that made a lot of sense. And so I guess part of it too, I mean, did you find that, you know, you kind of asked the question earlier in the conversation, was religion this sort of justification? Was it this kind of driving force? Did you find anything that you didn't expect regarding religion or religious motivation when you were doing your research?
I found both sides of the coin, so to speak. Mm. Some people say that, you know, religious motivations drive events. Others say that events are driven by political motivations or economic, and they're conveniently wrapped in religious motivations. I saw both in the book. I think, to take probably the most religious person in the book, Queen Isabella, that her faith, and Columbus's faith, were absolutely genuine, and that the actions that she took, you know, from the period when she became queen in the mid-1470s through 1492, which includes, you know, the conquest of Islamic Granada, the institution of the Spanish Inquisition, and ultimately in 1492, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, were religious driven on her behalf. Yes, there were other motivations. There were economic, there were social, there were political motivations. But I saw in the record, and, you know, thinking about her and parsing through secondary sources as well, a real religious motivation. Columbus himself had a growing religious faith through his life. He starts out, you know, as most kids, being indoctrinated, and I don't use that word in a negative sense, but in kind of analytic sense. But then as he becomes a seaman, you can tell his writings get increasingly religious during his life. Mm-hmm. And he does view that, you know, not only is he amassing a fortune of gold in his view by discovering things, but he is bringing faith to these people he's going to subjugate. There are others in the book where I think, at least on the European side, you know, faith is more of a wrapping rather than a motivation. Hmm. I think you might say that about Isabella's husband, Ferdinando. You know, it's I don't want to offend anyone, but the Pope himself, Alexander VI, clearly, faith to him is not just a matter of faith, but it's a matter of his jurisdiction and revenue. Hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he clearly has a institutional
mandate or
impetus to declare the new world mm-hmm. his diocese.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
And speaking to this, to religious underpinnings to this time frame and the narratives that are going on, I wanted to ask about your title, The Encounters Unforeseen, because when I'm thinking about this period, and especially in relationship to this title, it evokes this imagery of a myth with the Aztec and with the Maya, that there were these folks from across the sea who would come and change, if not destroy, their worlds, and that we tend to look back today thinking about this, that for some reason many cultures in Central America and Latin America today thought, or they tended to foresee, that there was something that was going to happen to them. And I wondered if this is what you were trying to go for with that title.
Actually, the title was, in my mind, more analytic for both peoples. The Tainos, like the cultures you mentioned, did have a genocide prophecy.
Uh-huh.
But I was more thinking that the encounters were not seen by either people.
Hmm.
Columbus, and to the extent they gave credence to what he was doing, which I think was low, Isabella and Ferdinand thought he was going to Cathay, China, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Leif Erikson and Norse explorers had found Greenland and islands or mainland west of that. They were kind of perceived as European extensions at the time. They did appear on maps. People in Europe, or at least in Spain at the time, thought the Atlantic Ocean stretched basically from the end of Terra Firma, Cape St. Vincent in Portugal, and the coast of Africa, to China. So it took a couple of years after Columbus's discovery for people to begin to think otherwise. So they really didn't have a conception of America there, although I'm not saying that Erikson didn't get there first. He did. But it wasn't something they thought about. The Tainos, on the other hand, you know, it's hard to tell their concept of geography, but I think most anthropologists believed that they felt they were on their Haiti was the center of a universe which was basically a chain of islands with a western shore that was enormous in Central America and South America, but at the center of a flat earth and at the center of their universe.
Hmm.
So there are, you know, historians and anthropologists who've written about how Native Americans went east at various points in time. But I think the Taino people, where Columbus went through the Caribbean, had no conception that there were men as opposed to spirits that lived over the eastern horizon.
Hmm.
So the encounters were unforeseen by both.
Hmm.
And I was thinking that was a good title because it fit both people's mindsets.
Yeah, no, that's nice. Yeah. Yeah, it makes me think too, there's the idea of the sort of the unforeseen. One of the pieces I enjoyed that I wonder if you can talk about is that, you know, when we do think that whatever group we look at or whatever perspective from each group we're thinking with, they, you know, tend to see themselves as in some sort of center of the universe, and i.e. there's some sort of others or outsiders. You know, in anthropology, we talk about this simply as the emic insider and edic outsider viewpoint. And one of the examples I thought that illustrated that really well was the question of cannibalism, right? As Columbus began talking with his Taino captive, and there was like this kind of misunderstanding that sort of generated. I thought that was really interesting, and you could tell us a bit about the question of cannibalism, how that became part of the story.
Yeah. Let me step back and just note one thing.
Sure.
What I tried to do in terms of, I forget the words you just used, but in terms of origin stories, mm-hmm. was present both cultures' origin stories. You see in an early chapter a recitation of how, you know, in our monotheistic three religions, God formed the earth and terra firma and made man in 7 days. The Tainos had an analogous kind of origin story where men came out of the caves that were in central Haiti to populate the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to do those both. Cannibalism. You know, cannibalism is a very tricky topic because there is not agreement about whether it existed.
Mm-hmm.
I think most anthropologists agree that the Tainos had cannibalism in their myths. You can see in my book that the captives Columbus first seizes on the Taino Guanahani, which mm-hmm. we believe to be San Salvador, believed that when they came south to the larger islands in the Caribbean, in particular Haiti, that there were cannibals there. I think historians generally agree, and it's abundantly clear, that Columbus and his successors used the assertion that someone was cannibal to enslave them. So you have kind of an agreement that the Tainos themselves had cannibalism of peoples in the Caribbean in their myths, and Columbus and his successor conquistadors use cannibalism as an excuse to enslave people. But there's not agreement whether there was an actual practice mm-hmm. of cannibalism.
I see.
I think there is agreement that the Caribs, the people that lived, the tribe that lived in the Eastern Antilles, engaged in looting and wife raiding for the Taino, in the Taino tribes in the western part of the Caribbean. And that those two sets of people, Tainos and Caribs, had tribal skirmishes. So the second, or in the second chapter of the book, I depict one of those skirmishes. It is a depiction Absolutely. Of wife raiding, where the Caribs come to Haiti, which is a very long journey by canoe. I mean, it's a pretty exceptional ability as a mariner to do that.
Yeah.
And raid a village to steal women to be wives, concubines, slaves, so forth. I don't depict cannibalism. So I'm particularly careful on that. So, you know, you guys would know better than I, but there are many anthropologists who say, yes, the Caribs practiced cannibalism, to the extent of it being a kind of a symbolic thing. Some say it was actual eating. Some say, no, there was no such thing, and there's no proof that there was. I didn't have to deal with that issue in my book because it's not relevant in the time period. I am going to write what happened in the next decade, and I'm going to have to deal with the issue then because Columbus clearly believes he's found cannibalism in Guadalupe when he comes back on his second voyage.
So speaking of this, I mean, you've done so much massive research, compiling all of this data to share these stories from multiple perspectives in a way that humanizes them, in a way that makes them approachable to contemporary readers today. So what stories do you have planned out next? Is there a story that you feel that you really want to tell, but maybe it'll take a long time to build towards?
Well, I want to continue with the history. The history really can be broken down into four parts. The book I've just written, which takes you through what might be called a honeymoon period, when neither people really understands that the other is the enemy. The Tainos certainly don't understand that until the end of my book. And Columbus is under the impression that he will be able to, quote, peacefully subjugate the land without resistance. Well, stop, that didn't happen. In 1494, when Columbus brought 17 ships over and over 1,000 settlers and guns, and a cavalry, a small cavalry, and so forth, Very quickly, it descended into war, then began the brutal subjugation. So the next thing I've just begun to work on it, actually, is a period in the history from 1494 through 1496, which is the brutal subjugation of the Taino people, the period when Columbus and his men, not of all whom we could control, commence enslavement, and the period when diseases from both civilizations ravage the other. And then I do intend, although it's going to take some time, and I hope I have the time, to take it through the participants' death. The reader of this book will, you know, have been introduced to three Taino chieftains, and a Kaona chiefess, Columbus, Isabel, and Ferdinand, and the captives, and they can all be followed through Columbus's death in 1506.
Yeah. And that makes sense in terms of sort of capturing it into that, and that this kind of four part. And it's interesting too. I mean, I'm curious to think too, because it is chucky. I mean, there were some parts in this book that were really kind of gut wrenching, right? And this is, as you said, the honeymoon period, right? And we know the story gets worse, and so there is really almost this like sense of like foreboding also that's part of this tale that I think both makes it compelling and difficult, you know. And so it's commendable to take.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You can see in this book, Columbus does, you know, violent acts. They're not systematic. They're directed at captives and taking captives and tricking people as to what his true intention is. But for the most part, there's not a lot of violence or warfare in this book. What you see is the conceptual underpinning of the European subjugation of the Americas. You see Columbus's thoughts, Isabel's thoughts, the Pope's thoughts. So the conceptual framework is set.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously captives are taken and maltreated and so forth. It's before the period of disease. It's before the period of a mass brutality.
Mm-hmm.
That comes in the next book.
Mm. Cool. Well, I want to say thank you so much. Like, it's both a positive and a sad note to end on, because I'm excited to see what comes out next and how that research takes place. As well as, I want to thank you so much for sharing this book with us. Are there any kind of final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with, as well as where can we get in touch with you? Are you on Facebook or Twitter that people could reach out if they wanted to offer reviews or questions?
Well, you can buy my book all over the place. Awesome. I mean, obviously Amazon, you can go into your independent bookstore, and if they don't have it, you can ask for it. Hmm. It's in hardback copy, and it's an ebook. You can buy an iBook. You can buy a Nook. And I have a Facebook page where I, you know, post not just about, interviews like this, but I have been giving over the last month a kind of synopsis of the protagonists. Who were they? You know, the three Indian chieftains, Kanabo, Garinex, Guacanagari, the captive, Columbus, Isabella. And in my we didn't really talk about this, but I went to most of the places,
mm-hmm,
where the action takes place in my book, and I begun to post photos of that. I also have a website, and that, you know, has the reviews for the book, you know, the Kirkus review, the this review, the that review.
Mm-hmm.
And I also post a blog there which, you know, some people are beginning to enjoy. It didn't start until October. The book wasn't released till November. Mm-hmm. But every now and then I make a brief post about what happened on this day 525 years ago.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
If you remember back in October on Columbus Day, the mainstream press was focused on this is the 525th mm-hmm. anniversary.
Right, right.
Well, every day from October 12th through March 15th of next year is the 525th anniversary of something that happened on the voyage. And so I post about, you know, what happened on the voyage then. And sometimes I'm going to post about when the assassination attempt on Fernando next Thursday, 2 days from now.
Very interesting.
So it's all in the book, but it's kind of fun.
Absolutely. All right, right on. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so we just want to thank you so much for speaking with us. It's a great book.
It's been a pleasure, guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Hey, listeners, you've just been checking out our interview with Andrew Rowan in his new novel, Encounters Unforeseen, 1492. As we said, the book just came out last month in November 2017, and so we'd love to hear what you think about it if you have a chance to check it out. As he said on his Facebook page and his website, he posts different bios of the characters, of the protagonists, and different sort of synopses of them. And this is a really good piece of reflection to think on, because this kind of novel is designed and intended to be, we said, bicultural, right? That it is sort of open to treating all characters equally. And this is particularly important for something like, the Spanish conquest, because as much as, we may revile some of the characters, other people might be inspired by them for better or for worse. And depending on who you're talking to and listening to, it's, what does it look like to tell this kind of story when every human is just that, a human?
And capturing the logic of peoples that we can barely relate to today is something that's very important to recognize about what this novel does. When we're thinking about this interaction, we tend to view it as, well, the Europeans came and interacted with the indigenous peoples of the New World. But even our understanding of who these people were, the Europeans at the Renaissance, is something that's widely misunderstood today. And I was listening a lot to Myths and Legends podcast recently, where the main narrator of that podcast talks about how if we were in the same room as somebody from medieval Europe today, we would be speaking to each other as if we were from different planets, right? And it's not that far removed from these perspectives about Columbus and the Spaniards that he was sailing with at this early point of time. Would we have actually recognized the logic? And in many ways, no. Mm-hmm. So to be able to see both sides or multiple sides and the logic around them being formed and approach it in a very human way, I think creates for a very compelling narrative that breaks down many of the barriers we tend to put up and attribute to this contact period.
Yeah, well said. And so we want to say that if you've enjoyed this kind of episode, this is a new thing that we're trying at TAL. This is part of our sort of Patreon self-funded, public-funded expansion pack, as it were. And our hope with this, as you said, so we are doing crowdfunding on Patreon now. And what this is a simple online crowdfunding platform where people can give, as little as a dollar a month. That's less than a cup of coffee, or less than three cups of coffee per month, I suppose, if it's, $4 a thing of coffee. But the idea of this, of course, is if you like the show, if you like what we're doing, you toss us a couple bucks, you can give one time or give a few dollars here and there. But our point is, we're trying to experiment with new formats like this, talk about authors with their books as we can. We've done this previously with Anita Hanning. Now we've done it with Andrew Rowan. And we want to keep this conversation going. We like having book conversations. It's a slightly different format. Obviously, we talk a lot more with the authors and hear a lot about what they have to say. And we enjoy it. And so, again, if you like this, this is something you want to help support and help us expand our episode kinds like this to have more book interviews, more author conversations. We can do it, and we love doing it, and so Patreon is one way you can show your support that can make it possible for us to keep expanding the kinds of work that we do to give us a little bit more time to put in these kinds of episodes.
Right, and of course, another way that you can support us and support this project is to give us a review on iTunes. Yeah. Every review helps. I mean, the more reviews that we get, the more that this podcast is going to come up in different types of news feeds and Google searches. So when you give back to us just by giving us a couple stars here or there and mm-hmm. giving us a nice comment, that's going to mean all the world of difference to us.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point, too. And iTunes is free for everybody else. So, yeah, that'd be great too. So any kind of love you want to share, we're happy to share with you all. And you know, keep in contact. You know, Ryan and I just came back from the annual meeting of the American Anthropological Association in Washington D.C. this year, and it was an amazing time.
Right.
You know, we ran around, like I think I said before this too, with chickens with our heads cut off, networking with people, hanging out at events. We ended up speaking on two panels that actually were recorded, so we'll be sharing those, and we'll talk a little bit more about those in a free thing that's coming up. But we are really excited that public anthropology and doing anthropology in new formats is exploding across the scene, and we're right there in the mix of the movement.
Absolutely, and of course, we can't forget that the theme for this year's meeting was Anthropology Matters, right? And this is a way of exposing how anthropology is sometimes a little bit under-recognized, and we're often to blame for this, but we can do better, right? Mm-hmm. We can take those charges that we've seen with past speakers like Elise Waterston of the AAA. Mm-hmm. We can do better. So how we do that is by talking, by communicating, and doing this project here.
Yeah, and we're going to keep doing TAL. You know, this is a labor of love, and it was such a genuine joy to hang out with so many people and talk to so many fans and interlocutors and fans who are interlocutors. You know, and interlocutors who are fans and whatnot, of people that are into podcasting. We met so many new podcasters. We got to speak on a panel about podcasting with a bunch of other anthro podcasters. And it was really cool just to see, like, just in the world of podcasting itself, there is such a big impetus of anthropological doing, as you said, Ryan. And
right.
That's really, you know, where we see the quest, and this is kind of where one of our strengths lies. And so we're going to keep rocking it. Yeah. So with that, you know, we'll catch you next time, probably with a free thing, talking a little bit about our post-conference thoughts. And we hope you enjoy today's episode and what's coming up. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Ryan Collins.
We'll see you next time.